There was an important study published not long ago by Ami Klin and Warren Jones at the Yale School of Medicine. They tracked autistic viewers' gazes as they watched the film Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? That's the 1966 Mike Nichols adaptation of Edward Albee's play. Biologist David Gruber wanted to know more about this experiment, so he visited the researchers at their New Haven lab.
Right now, Warren Jones is putting what appears to be a baseball cap on my head.
And I'm just going to tighten up this cap a little bit. You tell me if it gets too tight at all. Is that okay?
There's two cameras fitted into the cap. One faces forward, recording what I'm seeing. The other, an infrared camera on the bill, points backwards, towards my eyes.
So we're going through a little calibration process. If you could check out each one of those lights.
Once the gadgets are tuned, Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor appear on a TV screen. Behind me, Warren sits in front of a bank of computers. He's recording, frame by frame, the pinpoint location on the movie screen where my eyes are focused.
Martha, rubbing alcohol for you?
Sure. Never mix, never worry.
The camera knows how the eye is moving, and it knows how this computer screen that's showing the movies is located in space relative to the person's head.
Who's afraid?
Even in a psychology experiment, with a contraption on my head, I can't help but get sucked into the movie. It's a brutal depiction of a marriage. When Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was released in 1966, audiences were shocked by its portrait of emotionally dysfunctional couples. But show the movie to an autistic person, and it's a world they can't fully comprehend. Subtext and innuendo are lost on them. That's one of the hallmarks of the condition. These scientists are studying autism by looking at what an autistic person pays attention to on a movie screen.
This is one point in which poetry and neuroscience comes together. The eyes are the windows to the soul.
Warren Jones collaborated on this study with Ami Klin, the director of Yale's autism program.
Things that happen in the eyes have special valence to us. From a neuroscience standpoint, it's the point of connection between two rays of consciousness.
Ami Klin chose Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf for two reasons. First, he needed a movie with complex social situations. The other reason?
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was my favorite play and movie ever. That the person who wrote it and then the person who directed the movie were extremely successful in capturing the inner conflicts and the way that those inner conflicts of those four individuals took an expression in the scenes that unfolded. But more than anything, the fact that there is this, in a way, unrelenting rhythm to that play, going towards this climax, and the climax is really the explosion of this people's inner worlds in the presence of others.
God damn you!
In the film, a typical night of seething resentment between Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor is interrupted when a young, naive couple, played by George Siegel and Sandy Dennis, steps by for a drink.
Come on.
In one scene, Siegel confides to Burton that his marriage was predicated on a lie. His wife, Sandy Dennis, fabricated a pregnancy while they were dating.
She blew up, and then she went down.
And when she was up, you married her.
And then she went down.
Later on, Burton uses that information to humiliate her.
Stop it. Look at me, I'm all puffed up. Oh my goodness, said Blondie.
And so they were married.
And then?
What? And then what?
And then the puff went away again like magic. Poof.
But the fact that Richard Burton brought this up in the worst possible way and with exuberance and almost like this extraordinary pleasure at inflicting pain, pain through words, but immeasurable pain, was extraordinary to me.
Later, Ami and Warren show me printouts from a previous experiment. Squiggly lines show the eye movements of a viewer with autism and a control subject.
The scene is set up such that Sandy Dennis is on one side of the screen, Richard Burton is on the other. Richard Burton is talking. We're seeing the expression on Sandy Dennis's face unfold, her discomfort, and then the camera pans across, and it pans across Sandy Dennis's face to show her husband sitting on the opposite side.
Honey,
just couldn't have told them, please. No, you couldn't have told them. No.
And as that camera pans across, the typically developing viewer is still glued like a magnet to Sandy Dennis's face because you can see the anguish there that her secret has been told.
The camera pan tells us that Sandy Dennis knows her husband betrayed her secret, but a viewer is supposed to look at George Siegel for just a moment, even though the camera is shifting in his direction. A typical viewer will return their gaze to Sandy Dennis's face almost immediately. She's undergoing the emotional turmoil, and that is the most important thing happening in that scene.
When we did our research with this individual with autism, what we found was that rather than paying attention, rather than focusing on the social cues, he instead went with the camera pan. So the camera pan directs your attention to move to the left because something important is going to come there. And indeed, his gaze pans right across Sandy Dennis, right over her, to look at the young man. So he's responding to the physical realities of the camera shot, whereas many viewers are responding to the social reality of where is the most intense display of emotion.
It's amazing how the language of film is based on second-guessing where a viewer will look. This is especially important in a film like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which is adapted from a fairly static play.
I felt the extraordinary weight that you need to assign to people's internal realities, how they create solutions to complicated problems, and how those solutions become the very basis of their conflicted lives. And unless you have an insight into that and you impose your own sense of reality upon them, you will have absolutely no clue as to what makes them tick.
When Ami Klin was completing his doctorate in clinical psychology, he chose to live in a residence for severely mentally handicapped patients instead of the university dormitories.
And when you share lives in that way, morning, afternoon, and particularly night, with people with a completely different set of endowments and challenges than is your common frame of reference, it became sort of clear to me that in order to understand what the world looked like for those individuals, you had to step right behind their minds and their eyes and everything else.
The goal of his work with eye tracking is to use it as a diagnostic tool to detect autism as early as possible, which may lead to more effective treatment. In this vein, Ami and Warren Jones recently built a more child-friendly setup for eye tracking, and they've become filmmakers themselves. The child actors in this short film are also struggling for power, except they're fighting over something very concrete, keeping the door open or closed on a toy car. The primal urges that fuel subtext in adult relationships are played out with clarity. In other words, it's the normal world. For Studio 360, I'm David Gruber.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with Blythe Corbett, who is a professor of psychiatry at University of California at Davis and an expert on autism. Blythe, you're familiar with these Yale researchers' work. What's your take on it and what they're doing?
Yeah, Ami Klin and Warren and the group at Yale has done some extraordinary work in really contributing to our understanding of autism in a number of ways. One is that the fact that individuals with autism tend not to look at the eyes is extraordinary in and of itself. And we know that infants as young as 3 months of age have preferential looking to the eyes in order to get information about feelings and intentions. And the fact that these individuals, and in this case, adults, are not looking preferentially to the eyes, but instead are looking much more to the mouth, is really revealing. Those that did, I should say, had better functioning in terms of their social behavior, and which was a little bit surprising. But what they interpreted that to mean is that they were looking to the mouth for information. They were trying to gain a better understanding of the social situation instead of looking at the eyes by looking at the mouth.
How did you, Blythe, come to make this your life's work?
Oh, well, I actually was in the theater and other worlds before this, and through a series of events ended up going back to school, and I met my first child with autism when I was an undergrad, and we'll just, for the sake of confidentiality, I'll just call him Christopher. Christopher had a vocabulary of about a dozen words. He was 14 years of age. He wanted nothing to do with me when I first entered his school, and I started that intervention I was telling you about called video modeling, and he, within a matter of weeks, he not only would come running out of the classroom when he saw me, he couldn't wait to get started, and we significantly improved his language and his ability to interact with others. And he was really my ambassador to autism. And from there, I started working with children in their homes. And to this day, I always say that working in the homes with these kids, just like Ami Klin was suggesting, it was my first lab and absolutely my best lab, and being able to really get a good perspective of what it's like to have autism, but also to live with an individual who has the disorder.
And is there anything that you see on the frontier of genetic research that is sort of leading toward an explanation that will be useful for treatment?
Well, I think most people are talking in terms of that it's a polygenetic disorder, meaning simply that there's going to be many genes that contribute. And most agree there are also a couple other factors that are important. One is environmental. And thirdly is the timing in which some change or alteration occurs. And I want to stress, though, when we talk about environmental factors, we're not just talking about the external environment, but one area that's rather understudied is the intrauterine environment, the maternal environment when the fetus is developing. This is an area that now is just beginning to be explored more carefully. We know, for example, from Down syndrome that there are more cases in women that are older.
It's interesting that explanation you've given, that it's going to be this complex matrix of genetic factors and environment and timing. That is the explanation that's given for so many illnesses, cancer, mm-hmm. diabetes, whatever. As we know more, the complexity of the explanation doesn't give us the simple answer we crave.
No, we do crave it. Yes, we definitely do. But unfortunately, I don't think it's going to be that simple.
Blythe Corbett, I want to thank you very much.
I've enjoyed myself. Thank you so much.
Blythe Corbett is a researcher working at the Mind Institute at the University of California at Davis. You can find out more about the autism research that she and her colleagues are doing at studio360.org. Coming up, a new play proposing the idea that autistics represent some next human evolutionary stage.
There's so much language about normalizing people with autism, and I thought, okay, I'm going to take the opposite point of view and see how far I can argue it. So, autism is a way of restoring balance to the general ecosystem. Even as I say that, it kind of fills me with horror.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.